You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is October 12, 2023. It is 7:37 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And I wanted to talk tonight a little bit about Buddhist faith and also how that is impacted by Western Dharma practices. And in some sense, talking about dominant or power-oriented patriarchal structures and a more persuasive way of teaching, which is more community-oriented. I see that come up quite a bit. The more traditional Asian vehicles for teaching the Dharma, of course, are traditional and patriarchal and mainly male-oriented, it's, at least in Myanmar, where we were studying. It wasn't considered possible for nuns, for instance, to attain enlightenment. That was something solely reserved for men. And that it was your karma, of course, to be born as a woman and not as a man in each lifetime. and that rigid sort of structure, I do acknowledge that that structure has persisted for millennia as it is, carried down, and that it in those trifunctional societies where the religious path is one of the ways to ascend in society, we haven't really had that. I'm going to close the door. We really haven't had that since the 12th century when the merchant class arose and there was a shift in our the structure of our societies.
Putting the dog in.
Yeah, as you may recall your European history, the church was a very powerful organization and had a lot of property, and they didn't pay taxes. And when the nobility and the merchant class aligned, they basically took all of that from the church in a shift of power so that that was no longer a vehicle to ascend in society. In Myanmar, for instance, one of the ways that they take care of children and particularly poor children is they're given to the monastery and the monastery then raises them. We probably have an orphanage system, which is a public orphanage system, which is pretty bad, I would think. Foster care, that sort of thing. And I was at the monastery in Pinaluin when a child was brought that was going to then stay at the monastery. And he was an adorable kid who was probably 5 years old, who was all dressed up. He was assigned another monk to take care of him, who was probably 8 years old. He was taking him around the monastery and introducing him to people and showing them the ropes. And the kids stay there and they're educated and taken through high school. And then you have a choice to commit to the monastery and then they'll educate you through college all the way to a PhD level of education if you have the aptitude for it. And the Sayadaw that we studied with was one of those kids. And he had climbed up quite a ways, and it was quite impressive to see that. In the West, of course, we don't We don't really do any of that. The religiosity of people is influential in our politics. I think it's about what 28% or so of people who identify as a fundamentalist level of religiosity. In our system, they tend to be on the far right side of things, which has always been a paradox for me. I would have thought that they would be on the far left. But it's that question then that comes up between the dominant power-oriented structure of things and the persuasive side of things, where you don't need ideas or exchange or collaboration in the power side because you just have to go along with the people who are in power, and that the machinations there are really about gaining power. Christian?
Or do you have a sense of how these structures compare? I mean, obviously, Burma's like in a civil war, I think, still, but between like Burma, which isn't nearly as globalized as like Thailand, and whether these kinds of structures still exist in a place like Thailand that's sort of more plugged into capitalism.
Thailand is a monarchy, and so the nobility and the military, and then the monastic life is also very strong there. So I would still say that it's a trifunctional society in that traditional way, that it really hasn't evolved beyond that. The merchant class is also fairly strong. But I think that a vehicle, an upward mobile vehicle in their society is still through the monastic life. Authoritarian capitalism is, I think, the desired form of capitalism, since it doesn't require the persuasion of consumers to adjust the system that much. The dictates really come from the top. I suppose that that's true of our system as well, but we tend to be more a corporate-oriented consumer capitalism, and the consumers do have a sway in what is produced. We, of course, are moving in the direction of a monopolistic capitalism, where the media is controlled completely and the ideas that are allowed to circulate are quite limited in comparison to where it was when there were, hundreds of newspapers and that kind of competition. I grew up in Chicago, and Chicago was a two-paper town. I don't know what your city was, but it was the Sun-Times, the Tribune, and it was in the days of the kids on bicycles delivering the papers. They ride by and they throw the paper up on the. You could tell a Democrat from a Republican because the Democrats all read the Times, and the Republicans all read the Tribune. Almost nobody got both papers. When the Dharma came to the West, as the Dharma has done in all of the different cultures that it's entered, it begins to be affected. The transmission of the Dharma begins to be affected by the culture that it's in. I think that this is a natural thing that happens because we define things culturally. We're all conditioned from the beginning of our experience. Our initial circle is the caregiver, and then as we expand, it's say 18 months, and when we recognize really that we are autonomous and that we have our own agenda and that we're separate from that symbiotic relationship, we begin to move into the world of other people, and begin to be impacted by the culture, even though they have these gender reveal parties. And if it's a girl, guess what color the smoke is? And if it's a boy, guess what color the smoke is? I mean, that cultural indoctrination that, or that cultural training is so deeply embedded. I remember in the 70s and 80s when my peer group in their 20s were beginning to have children, it was yellow and purple as a resistance to the pink and blue of Christian.
You know how, like, you always hear about, it's probably not all gender reveal parties, but you always hear about them like burning down a forest because
like, those are the ones that make the news.
Yeah. My plan would be to not do like a color-coded one, but just if it's a boy, you burn down a forest, and if it's a girl, you just don't burn down a forest.
It's a very privileged position, Christian, because you have to have the forest to burn down.
Yeah, well, airplane tickets are cheap too, so.
My favorite is the one where you cut the cake and the color of the frosting in the middle is the reveal. Gone are the days when you just wait for the birth. Men are, males are different than females. In the sense of the body that you're in, but then the acculturation is so early on, it's hard to know. I was, you know, because gender has been a huge topic lately, I've been looking at it. And one of the things that's interesting is the emphasis on opening traditionally male occupations to females. You know, when I was in school, they didn't have STEM, but STEM is the one way that they talk about that. Science, technology, what's the E in math? Engineering.
A to like placate the artists. Like pretend like they're doing something other than just trying to get through.
It would be STEAM.
What?
It would be STEAM.
I think we should actually advocate for STEAM. So men have traditionally gone into STEM-oriented work, and women have typically been into the help side of things. And whereas culturally, women have adapted in a way that they are now acceptable on the STEM side of things, men still have not adapted to being acceptable on the help side of things. So that all of the teaching stuff, the nursing stuff, you know, men are the doctors and women are the nurses. All that is changing a little bit, but the guidance that will encourage women into the non-traditional female roles and support that's necessary for that to be able to happen is more in place than it is on the male side. Men are not well supported into going into the traditionally female jobs. And so I think that moving toward a gender neutrality really is moving toward supporting both sexes. My favorite thing in the paper this morning was that they were thinking of reviving a wood shop and home economics. And I was thinking in high school that all people should have to take both. That would be a good solution to that. One of the things that I'm noticing in the practice, and I started talking about this as the idea of a Buddhist faith. In Buddhist faith, at least the way that I was taught about it, it isn't that absolute faith of more monotheic religions. It is a faith in the transmission of the Dharma. And then we take on the practice of the Dharma and investigate for ourselves whether or not we can understand the teaching through direct experience, so that we take on faith that the teacher is offering the Dharma to us in a way that's meant to be helpful to us. So in some sense, it is a expression of epistemic trust. That you believe that the person is telling you the truth, that you believe that the reason that they're telling you in the way that they're telling you is so that it will be helpful to you, and then you are free of admonishment in accepting that, so that you can explore and understand the nature of what the teaching is and how it applies to you and your conditioning. That making sense? So that would be, I say, would think is the persuasion side of the equation. Christian?
Do you think that because it's ultimately sort of an experiential practice, that there is kind of this unchanging core that gets transmitted regardless of whatever cultural, like conceptual baggage is always shifting around, what, like when it's moving around? Or do you think that actually that affects the experiential part of it too?
I think that you have the experiences which are associated with the practice that you do, that there isn't a practice, all of the practices do not produce the same outcome in terms of the understanding of things. An example of that would be the focus of not self in the Theravada experience or practice, and how those types of meditations tend to affect the brain, and how the effect on the brain tends to produce the result. So that when you, I would say wildly paraphrasing Judd Brewer and Dan Brown in terms of the study that they did with advanced Theravada meditation meditators and advanced Tibetan meditators, and how the effect of the practices changed the appearance of the brain. And Shinzen had always talked about how the practice you do is the experience that you have. And I have always thought that that was a useful insight. And so because I like Dharma maps, and I particularly like the progress of insight in the way that Mahasi Sayadaw taught it, that each of those insights that are described in those 16 stages, you can do a particular practice for, and that practice will illustrate for you the insight that you are being asked to understand. I've always been very practical minded, and not very esoteric experience oriented, it might be a way to put it. Some people like the psychedelic states that come from different kinds of practice, but I haven't found, or didn't find, those states particularly useful in the practice of living my life. Life for me has always been very challenging. I for most of the first, I don't know, I'll be 70 in a few weeks, or my 70th birthday will come. I think of it as I've been living my 70th year on the planet, and I'll celebrate the end of that and then start 71. But up until my 50s, I didn't function well enough to reliably have an apartment. So the changes that have happened as a result of the practice are, you know, for me, quite phenomenal. And I really appreciate how that worked out. But all of those esoteric states and all of that exploration was way beyond my level of privilege at the time. I was really just trying to deal with the fearfulness of being alive. And I can see from this vantage point that that's more appealing. Some of the esoteric bond practices that Dan Brown used to teach took me into these incredibly psychedelic places, and a deep sense of the most profound sacredness in all moments of life were very visceral, present. And that was very altering in terms of the experience of this limiting identity, the so culturally conditioned, so affected by the early conditioning of my life. And when I was free of the family system, the limits that were imposed from that kind of upbringing were so challenging to deal with. So having moved beyond that into a place where it isn't, the task of the day is not managing the overwhelming fearfulness, is incredibly wonderful. That alone, without any of the esoteric states that come from different kinds of practice. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was drawn to Shinzen's teaching and also the Theravada path, because it was so practically and it's so orientation. But then I know when in reviewing the Brewer Brown work on that, those meditations tend to shut down the ACC, which is the sense of self. And so you come out of the sense of self and that strong identification with limited identity. And in the practices that Dan was teaching, you move from the prefrontal cortex to the lateral side of the brain, which opens up this huge spaciousness in it. And when you get oriented that way, that the endlessness of everything and that, for me, I'm a visual thinker, and so those practices were quite enjoyable in terms of the visual experience of them. The Six Lamps practice, you're visualizing experience, and first there's a quality of the room filling up with smoke, even though it isn't, and it's a brightly colored smoke. And then there's a kind of glassier jewel-like lattice that takes over everything. And there's this very psychedelic. And then the visual field breaks up and you're soaring. Really, the experience then overtakes the body. And you're, in some sense, flying. And it's, all of that is quite remarkable. And then of course you land back in the solid world of ordinary meaning, the back and forth. I was in my early Theravada work, this is the early 90s, with a teacher that was from the Zen tradition and quite emphatic about the instructions and was constantly berating for not getting it exactly right was not a good fit for me because I didn't have the attention to really be able to do any of it. And I was used to a cruel experience, cruel treatment, and it just was not at all what I could manage. And so I have, from the very beginning, rejected the authoritarian, dominating power orientation. In fact, really doesn't make much sense to me. And always have preferred the persuasive side, where it's actually a dialogue and people are not in authority. And so I think that I like to teach in that way, to bring up ideas about what might be useful, and then to encourage you to explore them, not because I want you to identify with them, but I want you to explore your own conditioning, your own experience, and to understand the nature of the human condition that is this process of collecting sense data and assigning meaning to it and then forming the appearance of the solid world that you operate in. In the West, of course, we're used to that very early Aristotelian idea of we are visual people and we take in the outside world through that particular sense gate and we create the appearance of a world that's solid. And in that Aristotelian view, we take in an accurate and thorough representation of what's there and create a neutral representation of that. This is very different from the Buddhist idea or the Eastern idea that we really have a preference or a hierarchy of what's interesting to us, and we just grab these little bits of data, and then we take that very curated selection from the environment and create from that highly curated selection of things a representation of meaning rather than a representation of what's there. Is that making sense? And so really the stance of persuasion is this idea of this is what I think is going on. What do you think is going on? If you're in that stance, of course, your understanding is that you've just made a highly curated selection of what's in front of you and created a tableau from that. And everybody else is doing that. So everybody else's experience is going to be dependent on their conditioning. And there is no point of view that is accurate and that everybody has to maintain. Is that making sense? Some people really believe that they know what's happening and that they think that that's a universal representation and that they insist on it. That actually is terrifying to me. My experience of people like that is that they're frightening, that they're dangerous. I don't have a way of really connecting to that point of view. I don't feel a sense of safety. I don't see the paternal experience that I had was terrifying, dangerous, and that's how I tend to associate the patriarchies. So I like that community aspect where everybody has a place and everybody's opinion has a place, and that there's a dialogue that goes on without there being a definitive answer at the end of it, that we're constantly engaged in this process of expressing what our experience of the world is, what the meaning of it is. And then there's this exchange so that we really do get to a place of understanding what other people's point of view are, but also in the sense of safety that I derive is when I have the sense that someone else has understood me and that they see me, that has a value. We also tend to be quite moral in our judgments of other people and being unseen is one of the fastest way to activate that sense of moral outrage, that they don't really pay attention. They're not really understanding the expression and they're not valuing it. Is that making sense? How does a system then of teaching evolve in that? There's a way of expressing ideas and understanding how people relate to them and then their process of understanding how that actually is expressive or not expressive of the conditioning that I've, that you have developed or experienced. But when you really get into this, the nature of culture, I think what's interesting about cultural learning is that it is the thing that has really made the human animal the dominant species on the planet, because we're able to convey these elaborate processes generation to generation. And then each generation adapts that learning to the current situation that we're in. And so that technology is passed down and the developments and improvements are passed down. And that cultural learning is the thing that has propelled us into this state that we're in. And so what is so evident in our current period with this mass communication technology is that the controls of that, particularly when they're so stifling of a general expression of ideas, is that the authoritarian side is grabbing a hold of all of that, creating the appearance of something that's open when it really isn't. And with the advent of AI, seeing is not believing. Hearing is not believing. Nothing is reliable in that way anymore. Everything can be invented. So what do we do then with that experience where there isn't veracity left in the discourse? Which it, again, pushes me more over to the persuasive side of things. The power side of things is just to control all of that and push out what would be preferable. And then if you push people into aligning with whatever that point of view is, then we have these, what appears to me to be these wildly distorted representations of reality and an adherence to them that is unbreakable in a way. There used to be a term, I haven't heard it recently, of the flip-flopper, whereas on the far right, you hold on to an idea and that's it, once you've made up your mind. And there was some research that I saw that showed that conservative thinkers and liberal thinkers are all open to the ideas that are novel. But once the conservative brain makes a decision about it, they deflect all additional information about that particular idea. Whereas in liberal thinkers, they constantly take in the new information and reevaluate, which is what creates the experience of flip-flopping for the conservative mind. And it was linked to the structure of neuronal tubes in the brains of different people. So the upper cortexes of the brain are five layers of tissue, and they're connected with these tubes, and the spacing of the tubes is what they were associating with the conservative tendency of a brain, or a liberal side of the brain, which they also associated with autism and dyslexia, which made me really happy because I'm so dyslexic. Finally, there's evidence of the usefulness of that. If everything is impermanent and everything is changeable and there's no intrinsic meaning to any particular thing, then that open flowing expression of ideas is really useful. But at the same time, it is tied to things that do exist. That's one of the great paradoxes of the understanding of this human condition. We are, you know, we have this unique, well, not completely unique, but unusual experience of being born with our brains partially formed and being one of the species where the direct interaction with the environment actually changes the physical structure of the brain. And so we come out of these early experiences of childhood, of which we have no memory, of course, because that part of the brain that would record autobiographical memory hasn't developed enough to be functional. And it takes years for that to happen. The procedural part of the brain develops first. And so we learn all of these strategies for being in the world that are based in our family systems and are passed down generation by generation. And then by the time the autobiographical capacity of memory is online, 4, 5, 6 years old, all of that underlying structure is already in place and already been functioning for years. And when we talk about this expression of reality that we create in the mind, the very first experiences of that that we can recall, all of those systems are already in place. And so there's no real contrast to see the distortions in our perception of reality that's based on our early family conditioning. Is that making sense? And so one of the things that I really like to emphasize in this meditation exploration of understanding how we create the experiences that we have is that the conditioning is infused in all of it. It's, and because it was always present, we don't really have a way of contrasting it, to see it as a conditioned response. So we use all of these different techniques and these different angles of exploration to watch that so that we begin to notice. But one of the things that is really useful in this is an intimacy with other people so that they're willing to express to you in an open and clear way their experience of the same thing. Because that begins to create a contrast so that you can begin to understand the nature of how you form things. It is very difficult to get a handle on without that. So again, that pushes me into the persuasive side of things, where it's that openness and that willingness to have the experience of somebody else's perception of things that is so useful in terms of us being able to explore our own perception of things. Christian?
Seems like, to me, there's kind of a resonance between how you're describing that and when you talk about the Taja Panati, the rocking back and forth, and that's kind of a getting this kind of third thing from the contrast between the two perspectives.
Right. So Taja Panati, Taja means to reflect back, and Panati means conceptual reality. you reflect back on the ultimate reality and compare it to the conceptual reality that you've created, constantly doing that, rather than identifying with the conceptual reality and imagining that that's what's happening. So is that, as a concept, fairly well explained? Are you following me on that? So then let's do a meditation technique. I call it investigating self-generated emotion, which is meant to begin the mentalizing process of examining what's happening and how different sensing experience weave together to form the appearance of things. This is a Vipassana practice, so we're going to settle into that particular posture. How's that? Christian?
I had kind of a bugged out insight.
The best guide.
I wasn't thinking about this, but something was thinking about spiders.
Uh-huh.
I realized that the audible thought didn't produce anything, but then when I went to the visual, all of a sudden I felt the big emotion of like fear. So it's kind of an interesting to watch that, like, oh, only the visual component of the thought seems to be linked to like the emotional part of it for me. And I was curious if like other people might have a different experience of that.
Do you notice whether you're primarily auditory based or visual based?
It seems to, one doesn't really seem to dominate that much. I don't know. Sometimes one is more readily available than the other. Sometimes I almost think that I'm like, there's neither one would describe the way that I think.
Yeah, they all have to come together for it to be vivid. Otherwise, they're just a piece.
Yeah, I guess I couldn't imagine the scary sound that a spider makes, so I don't know.
Jessica.
I think I am definitely more visually oriented, and so I start to get like just completely distracted and pulled into like visual stories almost. But I also notice that it's really hard for me to make out what, like, I can hear. There's almost just like so much going on that it's difficult to have like a single thread of clear talk. It's like layers of voices almost. I don't know if that's like an ADHD thing or just, you know, like it's just like there's like a constant overwhelm in there. And that's something that is really difficult to kind of track. Yeah. Is there anything that I can do with that?
Practice more.
Yeah.
So that you have better clarity. I think it's a clarity issue.
Yeah, because I can pick up, I find I'm pretty skilled, I think messily, but I think I'm pretty skilled at picking up patterns in thinking, but it's not necessarily like there's a clear narrative. So,
for instance, I have an auditory processing thing. The way that I experience words are in the order that I hear them. And my mind doesn't necessarily order them by who's speaking them. So if I'm with more than one person, it becomes challenging to understand what's happening. And if I'm with a group of people and the and one isn't louder than the others, then it's easy to just hear a string of words and then have to begin to figure out what's happening.
Yeah.
So part of this is also an exploration of how you experience things, which is really good to know. You'll notice if you're with me in a crowd of people where there's a lot of background noise, I get silent because I can't really track what's happening in order to follow the conversation. Or it'll take me a long time to answer, which has nothing to do with profundity. But I think one of the things that it becomes really enjoyable to understand that that's what's happening rather than thinking that there's a problem with that. There's not a problem with it. It's just how you are. And so you want to then, I think if you could be excited by that, it helps with the practice of trying to actually figure out how you're going to understand things, because you are understanding them that way. And it can be very useful in terms of how reality is then appearing.
Yeah, that's actually a cool way to look at that. I like that. Thank you.
Someone else? Everybody good? So thank you for coming. I think we have some stuff coming up in December, but not until then. I will be away 1 week in November. Let me see if I can pull up the dates on that. I apologize for last week, but I was all set to do it, and then the electricity went out in the middle of my level 2 class, and then I switched to the battery on my laptop, and then the battery drained, and so I switched to my phone, and then the phone drained. And so then I sat in the dark until 3 in the morning when the lights came back on. So there was no way that I could get online. Thursday, November 9th, this class will not be offered because I'll be away. Thank you for coming. Really appreciate it. I do offer the teaching freely, but if you are able to make a donation, that's appreciated. It helps support me and also the work Meta Group is doing. There's a link on the website for that. So happy to have you practice, and we'll see you soon. Bye.